Thank you, Don. Yeah, I have to, you guys have never heard of me, so I have to go through some notes about myself. As my wife said when she married me, she didn't realize that four of my other personalities were waiting for me down the car. Well, it's a pleasure to be here at Salt Fork State Park in the wonderful state of Ohio at the 22nd annual Bigfoot Conference. But I think, you know, we've heard a lot of rounds of applause, but first of all, let's have a round of applause for the Keating family, Mr. Don Keating. His wife, Missy. Mom, Sandy, and sister, Jill. My talk tonight is the Bridgewater Bigfoot hoax in the Bridgewater Triangle. You'd never fit that on a t-shirt. And I'm going to tell you all about it. A little background on me, as Don mentioned, I've been researching paranormal phenomena in the Boston area for about 20 years. I've traveled to Loch Ness, Lake Champlain, studying lake monster anomalies. I'm a member of the, or former member of the Eastern Puma Research Network, it's now defunct, and other natural and wildlife organizations. I'm not a hardcore Bigfoot guy that goes out into the woods. I'm a Bigfoot historian, a folklorist. I study late 19th century and early 20th century accounts of Bigfoot, especially in New England. And I formed the former Bay State Bigfoot Society. I had that for 4 years. The BSBS, twice the BS of your average Bigfoot organization. One of the things I'm most proud of is I recorded a story by Martin S. Caden called Big Yellow. It's about Bigfoot in Vietnam, or a man-beast anthropoid. Search it on the internet. You can get it through my website. So I'm really proud of it. I recorded that in 1993. I've spoken here, as Don mentioned, for 3 years in 96, 97, 98. It's great to see Mark DeWorth again, Chuck Story, and everybody else back here. I've narrated a couple of Don's documentaries, including Ohio's Abominable Snowman. And as Don mentioned, we traveled to the Pacific Northwest twice. Attending a Bigfoot conference. We got to stay at John Green's house in Harrison Hot Springs. Got to interview Peter Byrne twice, meet the Sasquatch sleuth, Larry Lund. Where's Larry, by the way? Let's give him a round of applause. Yeah. How cool is that? You have Bob Gimlin from the Patterson-Gimlin film and the world's foremost authority on set film. Pretty neat, in one building, yeah. And I got to meet Grover Krantz and Renee DeHinden, completing the Four Horsemen of Bigfoot. And I uncovered the Scott McNabb Bigfoot hoax in 1998, and we'll get into that later. I've studied Bigfoot in New Hampshire. I have a neat story, if you want to hear it later, about a Bigfoot that attacked a taxi cab in rural New Hampshire. I collected over 24 plaster casts. I have a lecture in the Boston Public Libraries right now called Abominable. The cases that I really investigated closely were the Berkshire Bigfoot in 1989, and what I call the Tomato Thief case in Thompson, Connecticut in 1998. I conducted a mass mystery tour and a Hockomock Swamp tour in 2009. And as I mentioned, I don't own any camo or night vision camera, and I only camp in campgrounds. And as my wife says, if I'm off the grid for more than 24 hours, I break out in hot sweat. So, I've had a number of failed TV shows, radio shows, podcasts that no one's ever heard of. They never got off the ground. I was podcasting before people knew what podcasting was, but I do have a new show coming out called The Para View with five lovely women in the Boston area. It's a female view on paranormal phenomena. Look for that coming out in about a month. I'm a diehard UFO researcher, having traveled to Area 51, Roswell, New Mexico three times, Gulf Breeze, Florida, interviewing Ed Walters, the San Luis Valley, site of cattle mutilations. I've interviewed Chris O'Brien, Los Alamos, Dulce, New Mexico, Aztec, New Mexico. I conducted one of the final interviews with Betty Hill. It's on YouTube. I call it the Lost Betty Hill interview because it stayed in a box for over 10 years before I accidentally found it last year. Been to Shag Harbor, Nova Scotia, site of a UFO crash in 1967. Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, site of a UFO crash in 1965. Been to the Skunk Works, Wright Pad, as some of you have, Eglin Air Force Base, Holloman Air Force Base, White Sands Missile Range, and a number of great UFO personalities at my mass UFO show, including Bud Hopkins and Chris Stiles. I do another lecture called the Los Angeles Air Raid, a relatively unknown UFO encounter that took place in February of 1942, where a UFO hovered over LA and was fired on by anti-aircraft batteries. And I'm a dissenting member of MUFON, 15 years. MUFON stands for Many Useless Folks Organizing Nothing. Mm-hmm. I have attention deficit disorder, and I'm an obsessive compulsive. I own nearly 1,000 URLs. I just bought up the suite of RussianNaturalGas.com, so if I go missing in the next month, you'll know why. You want to track me down, JohnHorrigan.com, my pro announcing career, announcer.org, or USHistory.me for my history. I'm a reenactor with the Revolutionary War with the Lincoln Minutemen, although I do not belong to the Tea Party. I'm a historical lecturer with specialties in historical weather, historical astronomy, great fires, and historical economics. Belong to the Economic History Society, the Watertown Waltham Historical Societies, and my favorite, the Society in Dedham for the Apprehension of Horse Thieves. They've been together for 200 years. And again, I apologize. I see life as a hockey game, and I call it as such. So if I break out in a rat-tat-tat play-by-play, I apologize, as Don mentioned. I'm a sports announcer with the Boston Bruins alumni. We'll cut a deal right now. You don't talk about my Bruins. I don't talk about your Cavs. Deal? Deal. I also cover Boston Red Sox alumni, and I'm the New England Patriots basketball announcer. I'll let you figure that out. I have a show on the internet called Atlantic Boxing Television, and I've done comedy basketball with several comedy basketball teams, including the Court Jesters and Harlem Hoopsters. My two conferences, Mass Monster Mash, Mass UFO Show. Don spoke there in 2007. There he is taking a photo of Nancy Talbot, Don Ledger, Carl Feinz, Chris Stiles, and myself. Now, before we talk about the Bridgewater Triangle, controversial author, but he's a good guy when you get to know him offline. And his name is Lauren Coleman, and he wrote what I call the seminal book of cryptozoology. Cryptozoology being the study of animals that may or may not exist. I call it the Sergeant Pepper of cryptozoology. It changed the culture of paranormal phenomena. I urge you all, if you're just getting into paranormal phenomena or you've never read this book, pick it up. You're helping out a good friend. It's a marvelous book. Mysterious America, Lauren Coleman. Bridgewater Triangle. Well, what is it? It's a 200 square mile area with its apex in Abington, Massachusetts. It's a southwest corner in Rehoboth, Mass. A lot of freaky stuff goes on there. And we're going to run the gambit this evening. And then the southeast quadrant is in Freetown, Mass. And a lot of things have taken place. Stonehill College, people reported hearing a little girl crying and laughing and footsteps in a gym built on the former side of a pool where the daughter of the school's president allegedly drowned. And again, this is folklore. I'm not saying any of this is true. Keep in mind that I'm trying to schlock my CD, Mysterious Bridgewater Triangle, tonight, and I own bridgewatertriangle.com and .org and .net. Just being clean with you. Taunton State Hospital, they turned me loose at the nervous hospital, said I was well. Slim Blade. And then a sonnet ledge. We're going to be going all around the Bridgewater Triangle tonight. That's a picture of the swamp there. So, Hockomock Swamp, okay? Well, this thing means it's the place where evil spirits dwell. And don't worry about the text if you can't read it. They'll be able to hear me in Columbus tonight. I'll belt it out, I promise. It's 5,200 acres of swamp and freshwater ponds full of quicksand, sinkholes, and suction mud. Large poison ivy growth, poison oak, poison sumac. 15-foot cat and nine tails and thorny thickets. It's the site of desecrated Native American grave sites. Some are thousands of years old. In fact, archaeologists have discovered a 6,000-year BC Native American burial ground on a place called Grassy Island. And as they were excavating the site, a strange substance oozed up from around the skeletons and reacted to the air, causing all of the photographs that they had taken to come out black. Native Americans considered the swamp a sacred place and were forbidden to go there. Other tribes called it the Devil's Swamp. There were several skirmishes that took place during King Philip's War in the Hawk. King Philip's War was a war between Native Americans and colonists in the East in 1675 through 1676. In fact, my aunt just found a barrel that had a hole cut out in it, and that's where her house is over 300 years old. That's where the people that used to live in the house, the whites, used to hide out when the Indian raids would come, and they'd peek out of the hole in the barrel. There were gruesome atrocities committed by both parties. A curse is said to have been placed in the area by the Ponkapoag tribe. Some have claimed to hear a whooping in the Native American tongue from deep within the swamp. Phantom campfires and a ghostly canoe paddler allegedly have been seen on Lake Nipponicket. A lot of Native American names here tonight. It's full of giant insects, poisonous spiders, including the brown recluse, dragonflies the size of B-17s. Angry mosquitoes that'll get you sick with Tripoli and West Nile virus. leeches and ticks, ticks with Lyme disease, large wasps and very aggressive hornets, fire ants, giant reptiles, gigantic alligator snapping turtles, giant snakes the size of stovepipes, black racers and water moccasins, oop alligators, that's out of place errant alligators. You know how people get pets and then when they're tired of them, what do? They throw them in the Hockomock Swamp. Freshwater eels, large bullfrogs, and allegedly a lake monster in Lake Nip. Now there's mammals as well, rabid bats, fisher cats, they're nasty wolverine type creatures, the black bear, porcupine, skunks, rabid raccoons, he's a mean one. The raccoon's only known predator is the automobile, I want to let you know that. And of course, coyotes and wolves. Phantom pumas. If you talk to wildlife authorities, they'll tell you that the last puma east of the Mississippi was killed and stuffed in Brattleboro, Vermont in 1889. Mountain lions, allegedly extinct east of the Mississippi since 1889, were spotted in Easton and Mansfield, Massachusetts in 1993. In fact, when I was living in North Easton on Chestnut Street, while viewing the planet Mercury at dusk in the late summer of 2001, I glimpsed a long-tailed, tawny-colored, large catamount slinking across a field with deer. The startled deer scampered away and the large cat slinked off into the tree line. Black cougars have also been reported. My point being, it's not extinct. Now, King Philip's War, I alluded to that earlier. It was a vicious war that raged between Native American tribes and Puritan settlers in New England from 1675 to 1676. Metacom, nicknamed King Philip, became sachem, or the leader, of the Wampanoag tribe, and he led deadly raids and fire sieges on colonial villages. He was eventually hunted down by Captain Benjamin Church of the Plymouth Colony. He was beheaded, drawn, and quartered, and just to prove a point, his head stood on a pike outside the gates of Plymouth for several years. And by the way, the photos that you see behind are relative to the subject matter that I'm talking about. There's a photograph of Annawan Rock. Well, Annawan, after King Philip was killed, took control of the Wampanoag Indian Federation. He was captured at Annawan Rock in Rehoboth, Massachusetts in 1676. There have been reports of orbs, and you're going to hear that all throughout my talk tonight, orbs, balls of light, phantom campfires, smoke with no source, and the sound of chanting in an Algonquin Indian tongue. There's a place called Dighton Rock, which I think is fascinating from an archaeological standpoint. It's located in Berkeley, Massachusetts, and was first discovered in 1680 by English colonist Reverend John Danforth, who made a drawing of the petroglyphs, and it was mentioned in the 1690 book by Reverend Cotton Mather, the pious one, in his book called The Wonderful Works of God. The rock contains a number of inscriptions by possibly pre-Columbian visitors, ranging from Vikings to the Portuguese to the Chinese to the Phoenicians. Characteristics of each of these languages can be found in some raw form on the rock. Well, the Corte Real brothers, in 1500, Gaspar and Miguel Corte Real set out and kidnapped 57 Native Americans and charted about 400 miles of the coastline of what is now Labrador, Canada. And again, the theme of committing brazen acts against Native Americans is continual in the Bridgewater Triangle, especially in the Hockomock Swamp. Well, Gaspar sent Miguel with two ships back to Portugal, but Gaspar was never heard from again. In May of 1502, Miguel set out on an expedition to search for his brother, but he too disappeared, although two of the three ships returned to Portugal after they were separated in a storm. Well, he's thought to have perished in a severe storm, and the sole surviving brother, Vasco Annes Corte Real, wanted to sail in search of his brothers, but the King of Portugal would not fund such an expedition. He was out of dough. He had funded one 10 years earlier. Columbus. Some have suggested that Miguel Corte Real carved inscriptions on the Dighton Rock as a crude padreo, or Portuguese claim marker. If true, then Corte Real survived for years in the mainland of North America, and he preceded Pilgrim settlers by almost 118 years, and after he was believed to be lost at sea. So there's a strong population of Portuguese people in southeastern Mass, and they maintain that it's Portuguese were the first to settle in New England. That's, of course, if you totally ignore the Native Americans that were there for 2,000 years. Profile Rock. It's in Freetown Fall River State Forest. It's a giant granite outcropping from Joshua's Mountain. It's an image that Wampanoag Indians have held to be the face of the great leader Massasoit. As you can see it on the right. Legend has King Philip spending the night before his death at Profile Rock, maybe even knowing his fate, that he was going to get his head cut off and drawn and quartered. And it's part of a sonnet ledge. Now, this place is kind of a creepy place. As you can see, there's water underneath this abandoned quarry. A sonnet ledge located deep in the Freetown State Forest. Some suicides have taken place here, leaping from the 40-foot ledge. Abandoned rock quarry has been the site of many paranormal occurrences. Mysterious lights, ghosts, and UFOs. A lady in white has been seen there, just as a lady in black is seen on George's Island in Boston Harbor. And I'm sure there's a lady in blue, a lady in aqua, a lady in taupe, a lady in beige. And then puck wudgies. I have to be careful when I say that quickly because I might curse. Puck wudgies were brought to the public's attention by a friend of mine, author Christopher Balzano, author of the book Dark Woods. Puck wudgie is a Wampanoag, in the tribe that is native to this part of Massachusetts. It's a Wampanoag word for a small, hairy, troll-like creature. It was originally a nuisance for the people, but somewhere along the line it became evil and killed off the Wampanoag, creator god, and his sons. This is all Native American legend. They began killing the people and setting villages on fire. If you don't understand it, light it on fire. Puck wudgies were known to shift shapes, use magic, and use the souls of the dead to draw victims to places where they could attack them. These souls were in the form of orb lights, and most people were drawn to rocky cliffs that they fell from or water that they drowned in. Every culture has something like them. The name just changes. Allegedly, they've been seen in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and even in California and Virginia. There is a report of a woman who claims to have wrestled one, and another report of three men claiming that they were attacked by several puck wudgies on a sonnet ledge. And I think I have an explanation. Weed. Phantom orbs. Balls of light have been seen at the Raynham Dog Track and at railroad tracks. The Will-O-Wisp, it's been called, Jack-O-Lantern, St. Elmo's Fire, Foxfire, Marsh Gas. Spectre lights, spook lights, or ghost lights associated with graveyards. Glowing eyes have been seen in the woods of the Bridgewater Triangle. And, of course, UFOs, and we'll talk about that in a moment. 1968, five people saw a strange ball of light floating among some trees in a wooded part of Rehoboth. When they shouted a warning at it, they were terrified to see it suddenly expand to about 5 feet in diameter, and they fled when the orb began to move towards them. Another Rehoboth incident from about the same time period, a man looked out into a snowy field near his home and saw what appeared to be a Christmas tree brightly burning from the bottom up. He went out and investigated it and found nothing. Now, the Raynham Dog Track. This is one of the places, like the gas station, whenever you go there, you lose. Phantom orbs have been seen there, balls of light seen along the railroad tracks every January. There are tales of a headless track walker holding a lantern. Now, they didn't have iPods in those days, did they? I always hear about these tales about headless track walkers. Howling noises are heard near the dog track. Glowing eyes in the woods. Along a stretch of Route 138, there are odd things that happen, including roadrunners, and I'll touch on that momentarily. This is the picture of the power plant, a very creepy place. It's an abandoned cement plant, actually. Photo by Chris Pittman. Across the street from this dog track is an abandoned power plant, and allegedly, there lurks a dreadful entity, according to folklore. People hear what sounds like a person moving around deep in the swamp, off of the trails, with loud, crunching footfalls. You'll hear these themes repeated over and over. There was a major Bigfoot-type sighting here documented by Chris Pittman in 1999. In fact, this is the area. That's a photograph of where the Bigfoot was seen. Another photograph of that area. And still another of this path. This is near where we took our Hockomock Swamp tour. So, I believe in Bigfoot. I just don't know what it is. A tale has a teenager and his father on a dirt road in Bridgewater when they saw what looked like a little kid in a costume sitting on a brick wall. The kid gets up and runs, but its arms and legs seem extremely strange. It looked as if all the bones in his limbs had been broken. Another tale. One area resident looked into an old barn window and saw a small black thing that looked like a midget high up on a wall. The form seemed to disintegrate and move towards the witness like a mist. He fled and returned later, but saw nothing but heard weird screeching noises like a pig. Now, this is the area where we took our Hockomock Swamp tour. These power lines that you can see. Very strange things happen. UFO sightings, Bigfoot sighting here. Hunters go off on the left side there. And I remember walking down there. I was with a documentary crew. And walking down the path. It was a unseasonably warm December 1st of 2008, maybe. I was on this TV show. I forget what it was. Either way, I look in the tree and I can see orange, 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 orange. Hunters locked and loaded. You move, boy. You move off the trail. You scare that deer, boy. I'm going to put around just by your ear. Strange lights and noises in the sky above the massive power lines that run throughout the swamp. A Bigfoot-type entity was spotted lurking in the tree-lined swamp off of this embanked berm access road that runs under the power lines. That, again, happened in 1999. And again, this is the site of my Hockomock Swamp Tour, which plays into the story on August 2nd, 2009. Roadrunners. It's said that a ghostly phantom lurks in the Hockomock Swamp off of Route 138. This entity is sometimes glimpsed briefly and described as a weird figure. Late at night in 1999, a man was driving south on Route 138 with his young son when a horrible-looking creature came running out onto the road. He was sure that a collision was unavoidable, and he closed his eyes to brace himself. But nothing happened. One report has a strange entity that is seen ducking down in an empty car on Elm Street in Bridgewater. Elm Street plays into our story as well. It was described as having an almost skeletal face, white as a sheet of paper, without hair, eyebrows, lips, or a protruding nose. Demon Dog of Abington. In the spring of 1976, a giant black dog was seen ripping at the throats of two fallen ponies in Abington, Massachusetts. It was encountered by an Abington police officer named Frank Curran, who fired multiple shots at point-blank range at the dog, but the dog just ambled down the railroad tracks as if unharmed. It was about the size of the ponies, they were saying. Well, a massive search posse was dispatched, spearheaded by local police and environmental officials, and several residents reported seeing this dog throughout the spring of 1976. And as you know, black dogs, or hellhounds, are portents of evil and approaching death, especially in British Victorian literature. In fact, The Hound of the Baskervilles by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle features this theme. Birds Hill Thunderbird. In the spring of 1971, police officer Thomas Downey was traveling through eastern Massachusetts to his home in Norton when a large bird landed in front of his car. He stopped short. It was amazing, about a quarter mile down the road from where this incident happened. In fact, I went to school in the Bridgewater Triangle. Throughout my life, I've lived in this area. So he stops short. He sees this gigantic bird, and he estimates that this bird has a wingspan of 10 to 12 feet and glowing eyes. The bird flapped its wings, rose up, and flew over his car. And this was late at night. His description was that of a pterodactyl. Now, I tend to think that birds that you see, I was just watching hawks over the park here at the break, and, you know, scavenger birds, it's a good living for them nowadays. You know, seagulls the size of P-51s, you've got these huge crows that have attitudes. We have these things, I call them chicken of the end times, Canadian geese. Right? When things get bad, we're coming after you. Anyways, Officer Downey was scorned by fellow officers and nicknamed the Birdman. And to this day, he doesn't want to talk about this incident. Wants nothing to do with it. Swears it happened, but won't talk about it. And of course, I've located the exact area of this event. What about Thunderbirds in the Bridgewater Triangle, especially the Hockomock Swamp? Well, in 1998, a man reported seeing two gigantic birds engaged in a pecking talon battle above the Hockomock Swamp. A woman driving in her car with her husband in 1999 claimed that a gigantic bird with characteristics of a pterodon, that's kind of like a pterodactyl, came out of nowhere and swooped at their vehicle, nearly hitting the windshield and startling the couple. That's a creepy picture. This is The Dark Woods, again, Christopher Balzano's book. Great book on Bridgewater Triangle. He also has a book called Ghosts of the Bridgewater Triangle. Freetown State Forest. Well, it was purchased from the Wampanoag tribe in 1659 by the settlers. Many Native Americans have claimed that the odd and evil events since then are the result of a tribal curse. Skirmishes in King Philip's War were fought here. It's the site of various cult activity, including animal sacrifices. There's a high number of suicides that have taken place in this forest. Ritualistic murders committed by admitted Satanists. Gangland murders, over a dozen. In 1998, a single adult cow was found butchered in the woods. Also that year, a group of calves were... That's a New England pronunciation, isn't it? It should be calves. Oops, I said it. I'm sorry. Were discovered in a clearing, and they were grotesquely mutilated. Odd lights have been seen in the woods there. And then Taunton State Hospital. It's a weird place. First opened in 1854 to alleviate the strain felt by the state hospital in Worcester. It was originally named the State Lunatic Asylum. This day and age, not politically correct. Now a secure lockup and mental health facility in use by the Massachusetts Department of Youth Services, the Department of Social Services, and the Department of Mental Health. And you're wondering why taxes are so high with all these departments. It houses convicted juvenile offenders. Rumors of cult activity are at the hospital. Staff members would bring their more incapacitated patients down into the basement to conduct bizarre rituals to Satan. The basement still has unexplained markings on the walls. The staff, uninformed about the history of what has happened there, have reported cold spots that move with them throughout the basement. One staff member claimed he reached the final step only to feel himself stop. He closed his eyes and felt as if he were experiencing the awful things that had happened there in vivid detail. He quit the next day and still has trouble describing what he saw. So they were torturing patients down there. Remember, those the middle of the 19th century, they were still drilling out skulls and using leeches.
The copay was cheap, John.
The copay was cheap, that's right. There was no copay. And you didn't have a primary care physician. The dude with the drill was your primary care physician. Residents have had their lights turn on and off in the middle of the night. Many have also experienced a shadowy man who appears out of nowhere. Three common traits of this shadow man. His face can never be seen. He's always described as being male, and he appears in the corner of the resident's room in the middle of the night and stands as if watching them. Street light. The Dover Demon. Anybody hear this? Oh, cool. All right. Lauren Coleman, Joe Nyman, both friends of mine, brought this case to light. 1977, a Tony suburb in Massachusetts. I used to call for years the Dover Sherburn Medfield football game on Thanksgiving. I used to always get there early to the game, but I'd drive down the Dover Demon Road, Farm Avenue, Farm Street, Springdale Avenue. Anyways, it's April 21st and April 22nd, 1977, spring vacation for Dover Sherburn High School. Bill Bartlett, age 17, and his two friends were driving on Farm Street in Dover, Mass, when they saw a spindly, tan-colored humanoid crawling along a stone wall with glowing green eyes. An hour later, John Baxter, age 15, was walking home when he saw a bipedal creature similar to Bartlett's running into a gully and standing next to a tree. I went out and found this on the 30th anniversary of this sighting on April 21st, 2007 with Matt Moniz, a friend of mine. And he pointed out that the direction that this entity was moving was downhill along a stream, for whatever that's worth. The next night, Abby Brabham, 15, and Will Tainter, 18, claimed to have seen a similar-looking creature from Tainter's car crouched down by the side of Springdale Avenue. Never seen again. Ah, phantom clowns. This is not the Bridgewater Triangle, nor is Dover, but it was close enough, and it's a neat story where I had to tie it in. Phantom clowns. In 1981, there was a rash of evil clown sightings in Brookline and several other Massachusetts towns. Clowns in a van, with ladders on the side, tried to lure children with candy into their vehicle. One clown was reportedly Porky Pigging. That is, he was driving around with a shirt but no pants on. Pennsylvania and Missouri also reported phantom clowns that year. UFOs. Bear with me. I'm just going to give you a brief ancient history chronology. 1760, May 10th. Wow, almost 240 years ago today. I did that without a calculator. 250. Thank you. I need a calculator. Remedial reading. 10 a.m., a sphere of fire was observed over New England. Very good. Thank you, sir. It emitted light bright enough to cast a shadow in the bright sunlight. The sound made by the object was, oddly enough, was heard sooner at the middle of the course it took than at the beginning. In Massachusetts, this light was seen in Bridgewater as well as in Roxbury. Bridgewater was again visited on Halloween night in 1908, an incident that was well documented in the local newspapers. Two undertakers were driving a carriage from West Bridgewater to the center of Bridgewater when the incident occurred shortly after 3 a.m. They described the object as looking like an unusually strong lantern, about 2.5 feet in diameter, illuminating a large object resembling a balloon bag. They watched it for at least 40 minutes, and other witnesses saw it as well. It was seen to hover at times and then kept a straight, steady course. One of the undertakers wrote, quote, "I claim that a hot air balloon could not move in a circle or perpendicular as this one did." He also wrote that the object moved up and down, seemingly at will of some individual. There were many UFO sightings in the area during the mid-1960s, and two huge UFOs were seen landing near Route 44 in Taunton in December of 1976. In 1973, a UFO landing trace was found in the parking lot of Joe's Restaurant in Rehoboth after a spectacular UFO sighting there. And on March 23, 1979, two newsmen from radio station WHGH saw a home plate-shaped object amid a mysterious green light at the junction of Routes 24 and 106. January 1991, a green flying disc was seen in Bridgewater moving slowly and silently at an altitude of about 50 feet, illuminating a large area with a powerful spotlight. November 1997, a police officer in Bridgewater saw a very large triangular UFO with three white and two red star-like lights. And finally, December 10, 1998, a witness near Route 44 in Middleborough saw a strange, brightly lit craft with numerous red, green, and white lights maneuvering over Assawamset Pond in Middleborough. Does anybody know what the nickname of that pond is? I'm not going to say it in public. Let's go over the... Anybody going to go down to the shore of the... The object split into two, and then the two UFOs flew geometric patterns at high speed around the sky, displaying spectacular colored lights. The craft then joined into one again and disappeared. I love UFOs. Air Force planes were seen over the pond immediately following the incident, apparently reconnoitering the area. In the summer of 1999, 20-year-old George Lacasse saw a distant red light in Bridgewater, and it was moving all around. It was moving in shapes, and planes don't move. This is my favorite. Black helicopters, yeah. I saw one, and it's on YouTube. When the tall ships came into Boston Harbor on July 9th of 2009, clear as day, flying over. They're unmarked. They don't have to report to any authority, to the FAA, fly at any altitude, land anywhere. And I call this the chariot of the New World Order. These things, they're in hives all across America. And have at it, as long as you don't follow me. Mary Lou Jones Drown began hearing very loud helicopter noises in Rehoboth on June 25, 2002. No helicopters were apparent in the air when the noises were heard. She interviewed witnesses who told her that the mysterious helicopters, equipped with spotlights, were seen flying over the Palmer River School on the north side of Route 44, which is a common place for paranormal phenomena. Some reports described helicopters of the typical flat black or glossy black variety. Black helicopters, as you know, are traditionally associated with UFO lore. A farm owner in South Rehoboth told Mary Lou that two black helicopters with spotlights were flying in formation above the trees. The choppers came from the southeast from Mount Hope Bay in Swansea from Rhode Island. Another witness told her about a sighting a strange helicopter on Friday and Saturday, July 5th and 6th, 2002. Now keep in mind, I'm not going to do the math again. We're several months away from September 11th, 2001. It was like gray camouflage or a striped helicopter type. My story, and I'll finish up and I'm going to tell you another story. From August 7th through the 9th, and again on August 15th, 2002, mysterious black helicopters flew over Rehoboth again. Now, my thought is that there was probably some sort of UFO activity in that area. Or another terrorist. Cats and goats were said to have appeared nervous while the choppers were overhead. The copters were said to resemble the one in the TV show Airwolf. And on August 28th, 2002, the helicopter activity was described to be nonstop, even at night. Jones Drown said you could see their headlights. Now, I got back from Roswell, New Mexico, July 6th, 1997. I went down there for the 50th anniversary. I did that without using my fingers. And I told a friend that we had discovered a new part of the original debris field. In Roswell, they're all looking for these mythical flying saucer impact sites. The real story, Mac Brazel found debris in a field, and you've got to start from there. And he actually found it in late June of 1947, not on the traditional July 4th date. Anyways, I was talking to an investigator over the phone, and I gave him some details. That the next morning, I went down to the beach, and my favorite beach in Marshfield, Mass. I'm sitting on the beach, and I look down the beach, and I see this plane coming low. It's a C-130, 25 feet high, and it straight to the beach, came right over me. I ducked and threw my submarine sandwich, you call it a hoagie here or a hero, up in the air, and it fell on the sand, said some choice swear words. The thing banked off. I could feel the prop wash. It was so hot. And it strafed my father's house, which was 3 miles away. And just a very odd incident. Of course, I want to put myself into the story, even though I probably had nothing to do with that thing. They were probably running maneuvers on instruments. What about haunted graveyards? Well, Rehoboth Village Cemetery. The ghost of Old Ephraim is seen there, a man in 18th century garb. He has an evil, sinister grin. He's gray in appearance, and other specter lights have been witnessed there. Is there a cemetery that isn't haunted? Palmer River Burial Ground in Rehoboth. A sound is heard as if a little boy is crying. A loud wailing has also been heard here. Investigators have photographed orbs here, and one investigator claims that she felt a tap on her shoulder and heard a disembodied voice say, "Leave." The Mad Trucker of Copacut Road. Now I saw when this story germinated from one guy saying that he was being tailgated by a truck to some sort of phantom evil trucker. Dude's enjoying it. Hunter, you're into it. Little brother, all right. Well, the Copacut Road is in the Sonnet in Freetown, and there are reports there of a phantom trucker. Apparently, he flashes his lights, honks his horn, and waves his arms wildly. Some describe the headlights as being blue with orange lights above. I have an answer. I think it's the Walmart truck who's late for a delivery. The Haunted Schoolhouse, Hornbine School in Rehoboth. Everything happens in Rehoboth. Ghosts of a teacher and children are seen there wearing 19th century garb. They're seen inside the building, and some have been seen outside the building. Laughter is heard from the school grounds. Orbs, phantom orbs are seen as well. And then we have the red-headed hitchhiker of Route 44. That's a photograph in the middle of me back when I was under 200 pounds and Matt Moniz. The most famous phantom hitchhiker is Resurrection Mary outside of Chicago. And allegedly the phantom hitchhiker seen near that Seekonk sign on Route 44. Well, let's get it. Legend of a mysterious red-headed hitchhiker who terrorizes motorists haunts a stretch of Route 44 in Rehoboth, Mass. The specter is seen on dark, lonely nights, and it's claimed that he commits frightening acts. His hair is always red, and he's always dressed in a plaid shirt. One woman reported running over a man fitting that description late one night. Of course, I'm wondering if she was texting. The man seemingly appeared out of nowhere. And by the way, hit and run is now an Olympic sport in Boston, Massachusetts. The man seemingly appeared out of nowhere, and the woman, taken by surprise, had no time to prevent a collision. She was hitting send. When she jammed on her brakes and leapt out to investigate, she found no evidence of anyone being in the road at all. She did hear, however, a cackling laugh emanating from the woods alongside her. Frightened, the woman returned to her car and continued on. A few minutes later, the same thing happened again. The man appeared, and once more she hit him. Too frightened to leave her car, the woman rolled down her windows to inspect the road. After seeing nothing, there was static on the radio, and the disturbing laugh returned. Legend has it that if you flash your headlights and honk your horn 3 times near the Rehoboth-Seekonk line, the hitchhiker will appear in your back seat. I did this and got pulled over by the cops. Haunted police station. Rumor of a ghost that haunts the station in Freetown, Massachusetts. A dispatcher died at night while on duty, but was not found until the following morning. Pretty busy town. Oh, nice. Police on duty patrolling the streets and driving around just assumed it was a slow night. On a shift change, they found her body. Several officers have come forward with descriptions of a cloudy figure walking through the office. The description of the ghost is vague, but it did not appear until after the dispatcher's death, and most of the officers attribute the ghost to her. That was from Chris Balzano, Massachusetts Paranormal Crossroads. Bad Luck Pond. In the middle of the 19th century, there was a dam burst. The village of Rehoboth was flooded. 7 were killed. Other drownings have taken place here, hence the name Bad Luck Pond. Shad Factory. Palmo River Manufacturing Company was built here on the site of an old Joshua Smith grist mill who manufactured cotton yarn until 1826 when they expanded and renamed the factory the Orleans Manufacturing Company and began to produce fine cotton cloth. It was destroyed by fire in 1831 and rebuilt 1 year later. Unfortunately, it was destroyed by fire again in 1884. And people claim to have witnessed fires in these ruins that seem to vanish as fast as they appear, with no signs of smoke or burn damage. Orbs of light have also been reported in the woods. A male phantom is reported to move about the old factory site, which is very difficult to do with all of the thick overgrowth. Some have claimed to see a ghostly man on fire jump into Bad Luck Pond. And many profess a sense of dread and the need to leave when walking about the ruins. And now, the Bridgewater Bigfoot. How much time do I have, Don? I lost another one in the audience. Does anybody know? Well, because I can play this audio portion, or I can, it's on my CD for sale, Mysterious Bridgewater Triangle. Chris Pittman is the world's foremost authority on Bigfoot and the Bridgewater Triangle. I nicknamed him the godfather of the Hockomock Swamp. His website, www.bridgewatertriangle.org. And these cases, Chris has done a lot of research there. In fact, this is possible hair and fecal evidence. The CD is not fecal evidence. It's the bags of the right. That's for reference. of a man-beast anthropoid discovered by Chris in the Hockomock Swamp. Some more evidence. That looks like the barbershop floor. I don't know, just about me from a month ago, but... The Bridgewater Bumper Shaker. This is a famous story, retold and retold incorrectly over and over again. Spring of 1970, there was a spate of Bigfoot encounters in the Bridgewater area. Sightings of a large, hairy man-beast anthropoid. There were loud growls, glowing eyes, foul smells, and large footprints. Residents were alarmed. One night, police were dispatched to a Bridgewater neighborhood to investigate yet another report of a strange prowling creature. While filling a report out in his cruiser, a police officer felt something shake the bumper or rear of his cruiser violently. He threw on his searchlight just in time to catch a glimpse of, quote, a bear on 2 legs running behind a house. You know those circus bears, they're out there just ringing and running houses. Didn't want to say Bigfoot. the Deandreid encounter, known as the Hockomock Swamp Monster. Deandreid was the first to publicly document Bigfoot sightings in the Bridgewater Triangle. Well, in 1978, he felt that something was watching him while in the Claybanks area of Bridgewater. He claimed to see a half-man, half-ape creature entering the woods near the swamp. The John Baker incident. In late 1998, local resident John Baker was night fishing and laying muskrat trap lines from his canoe. The Taunton River had ice along its banks. Very cold night. Well, he felt that he was being watched and smelled a terrible odor. He heard ice cracking, and then a large footsteps were heard along the bank of the river. He claims to have seen the silhouette of a large bipedal entity that seemed to be monitoring his activity. And now we get to the main part of our story here tonight. And I need help from Dr. Meldrum at some point, Bob Gimlin, Larry, Don, and all the expert Bigfoot researchers here. I need your help when you look at this cast. Tell me if I'm wrong. Jason Lorifus. I met him in 2009. He's from the greater Burlington, Vermont area. He's the former leader of PINE, that is Paranormal Investigators of New England. He submitted spectacular ghost orb photos in EVP, that's electronic voice phenomena, to established ghost researchers in southern New England. He goes by the name of Ron Jeremy, spelling incorrect, and you know who he is, yeah. Who he was, on Facebook, and then he's Fox Mulder on Hotmail. So he's hiding behind monikers. That needs to be said. He's prone to very aggressive and angry posts on Facebook. Oh, my name is John. I've been addicted to Facebook for 12 months. I know every single third cousin that I've ever met, and every ex-girlfriend knows where I live and who I'm married to. Well, he attended my invitation, 2009 Mass Monster Mash as an exhibitor with his cast, and he tried unsuccessfully to get Lauren Coleman's endorsement of said cast. The Bridgewater Bigfoot hoax. On or around, this is my statement, you'll see Jason's statement. On or around July 15, 2009, Jason Lorifus of Paranormal Investigations of New England contacted me by telephone. I'm the last guy you want to call if you said you saw a Bigfoot. There are far more seasoned investigators. I'm just a folklorist. I always turn them over to the professionals. He was inquiring about possible locations to find Bigfoot within the Bridgewater Triangle. With his unsolicited inquiry of possible Bigfoot locations or hotspots in said triangle, I found Jason's manner to be very forward and somewhat blunt, actually. Well, he said to me, "Hey, we're all in this together." I said, "No, we are not all in this together. They eat their own in paranormal research, and I'm nobody's daddy." He told me that he didn't know much about Bigfoot, but he wanted to go look for it. Okay. It was at that point that I wanted to cruelly throw him a stick and say, "Go fetch, boy," in the hopes that he would not violate the proposed area that we were going to make a foray into very shortly for my Hockomock Swamp tour. We had an area designated where we were going to take a tour, and I didn't want him anywhere near there to compromise the area. It's a photograph here of Rhode Island, Connecticut, Massachusetts, the T area, and I'll get into that in a moment. So I asked him if he was a member of the BFRO, a fanatical Bigfoot research group. Thank you. He said he was not a member. I had been harassed years before several times by members of this group who tried to play a hoax on me. I then offered Jason my "for your eyes only" location. I knew of what I considered to be an active area where I had heard of odd encounters with an alleged Sasquatch-type creature over the last few decades. These were the roads south of the Douglas State Forest in Massachusetts, off of Route 16, leading into northeastern Connecticut, near the Thompson, Connecticut area, where I had investigated the tomato snatcher case. A woman who, equestrian, had a huge tomato garden and a barn. Some of you researchers know this. And basically something was going into her barn, killing chickens. It had to have had an opposable thumb to disconnect the latch. And she'd find huge footprints. She found hair remnants on her fence and half-eaten tomatoes. And when she went out riding several miles from her house, something, she said, was pacing alongside of it. And her horse was so frightened, it nearly threw her. And the horse died a couple of weeks later due to heart failure. That's the case in a nutshell. Well, I alluded that the area had alleged encounters as recent as 2005. So I want to send them west. You know, stay away from the Hawk. You know, not until we do our expedition. I told them about what I called the T area at the junction of the Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut state lines. I told him that the area had never been thoroughly searched by a professional tracker. Jason then told me that he had signed up for my Hawk Amok Swamp Tour on August 2nd. He mentioned names of my fellow acquaintances, so my tone changed. A friendly, I mumbled. Lorifus wanted to know where we were going on the tour. I had a defensive desire to keep our proposed expedition route confidential. I then threw him a bone instead of a stick. I mentioned some actual locations where a man-beast anthropoid had been reportedly encountered, whether by sight, sound, or smell. These areas were away from the expedition area, namely the Elm Street and Scotland portion of the swamp in Bridgewater and near Lake Nipponicket, just off of Routes 495 and Routes 104. So he asks where Bigfoot is. I tell him where there have been sightings historically over the past 60 years. And that's where the story picks up. Then, unexpectedly, on July 30th, I learned that Jason had found something on his expedition to the Hawk Amok Swamp. It's just a few days before my swamp tour. I telephoned him and got the details that, at the time, sounded a bit ambiguous. Essentially, he told me that he had pulled a plaster cast of a large footprint from a cornfield near Lake Nipponicket. I said, here's where you can find Bigfoot. He goes there and he pulls a cast. This was an area that I had told him about that had a history of Bigfoot encounters. I asked him to bring it to the swamp tour on August 2nd, and he agreed, with the stipulation that he would only let a few researchers, myself, Matt Moniz, Chris Pittman, Tim Banal, and Andrew Lake, review it after the tour. Okay, at this point, let me just see if this video goes off. Nope. Okay, I'm gonna go to my other file. Hold on for one sec here. Okay. Let's hope that this video runs. So, it's after the tour, August 2nd. We're throwing back a few suds, and he breaks out the cast.
Jason, can you tell me about this? Where was this taken, and where was it?
First thing I thought was Bluff Creek.
Andrew, what do you think?
This is phenomenal.
60 seconds. Let me look at your friend who's skull.
Chris, can you take a look at this, Chris? What do you think? If you could just take a look at this track here.
It's fresh, so be careful.
All right. Well, geez, this is unbelievable.
It's incredible. You take this really incredible piece of evidence, and it's awesome. You know, it's the best evidence to date.
That's Tim Banal behind him.
In July of 2009, I cast. Wow. That's a big boy. Look at the impression of the eel.
Okay, let me go back to the slab. So that's our first impression. Chris Pittman was the one handling the last. Matt Moniz, Andrew Lake is the guy with the camera, and Tim Banal was the guy with the hat, just observing and smirking. Okay. So, that's our first sight, and the story continues. Good. Okay. So we left the restaurant with Tim Banal, and we openly questioned the veracity of the entire event. We felt that there was no solid backstory behind it. The footprint was too perfect and shallow, and we pondered aloud whether it was a made-to-order hoax created especially for the tour, perhaps to impress some of the major Bigfoot researchers from the area, myself, Matt Moniz, and Chris Pittman, who would be accessible to him on the tour. And I don't mean in a bragging sense, it's just that we've been in longer than most people in the area, or that I know of. Anyways, I told Tim Banal that the entire episode reeked of a hoax, and I referenced a case that I had uncovered in 1998 that was perpetuated by a former prominent Bigfoot researcher named Scott McNabb. McNabb had claimed that he was chased out of a riverbed area in Tennessee by a Sasquatch-type creature in 1997. He had sent me and other prominent Bigfoot researchers, I think Don as well, Don Keating, a plaster cast of a large footprint that was allegedly culled from the event area a few days later. At the time, I knew that I had seen that footprint before. I thoroughly checked my plaster cast collection of large footprints, and I noticed that it was nearly identical to a widely distributed plaster cast taken from the area where the infamous Patterson-Gimlin film was taken in Bluff Creek, California, on October 20th, 1967. So he just was coughing up a regurgitated Patterson-Gimlin cast. I outed McNabb, and he soon dropped out of the public eye. Pew. One down, for the sake of Bigfoot research. So I drew parallels between that case and this one. It smacked of a dupe. Later, I spoke with Chris Pittman, who also questioned the cast's authenticity, but chose not to do so on video in the restaurant, as he did not want to hurt Jason's feelings. Pittman felt that we all could be the victims of a deliberate hoax, and that we should all be careful not to hop on board with the "it's authentic" school until a further investigation was conducted. We, Tim Banal, Chris Pittman, and myself, decided not to say anything publicly about it, thinking that the entire episode would just go away. Veteran 25-plus year Sasquatch tracker and researcher Don Keating of the Eastern Ohio Bigfoot Investigation Center also chimed in. He stated to me that, "John, this doesn't seem right, doesn't feel right," as he magnified the photograph of the footprint and meticulously analyzed the toes. Keating, as you know, has researched literally hundreds of these cases, and I trust his judgment. So, on August 14th, and I was just going to let it lie, I learned that Jason's encounter had hit the popular website, Lauren Coleman's Cryptomundo, and that it was now a national story. I saw the photographs of the footprint incident for the first time, and I must admit that I laughed out loud. It seemed too perfect, and I told my associates, Banal, Lake, Moniz, and Pittman, the same thing. Moniz, a proclaimed scientist, insisted that a scientific method of investigation should be applied before denunciation. I quickly came to the understanding that he was correct and decided to withhold further real or fake commentary until Moniz, who, like Lake, gives Lorifice a 100% credibility rating, an accomplished ghost and UFO investigator, had an opportunity, along with Andrew Lake, to go down to the area. I recognized the location from one of Jason's photographs, and I suggested to Lake, Moniz, and Lorifice that somebody should get down there and reconnoiter the area and present a case summary before the area is contaminated by every Joe on the internet who is into Bigfoot. I also asked Jason Lorifice to make a public statement regarding the cast, as it was relayed to Lauren Coleman and Cryptomundo through author Joseph Citro secondhand. Later on the 14th, I emailed and telephoned Jason, insisting that he work with Moniz and Lake for a follow-up investigation to the event area and to provide a subsequent case summary to dispel his detractors. When we spoke, I asked him outright if it was a hoax. I told him that I felt it was, that it was a hoax, and I was somehow responsible for this, and that I would make it go away if it was a hoax. I kind of feel like I led this guy along and he wanted to impress people. I told him that right now would be an ideal jumping-off point and that it would hurt him and his organization's credibility if the hoax were allowed to continue. Well, that day is today. I expressed my skepticism. He told me outright that it was not a hoax. I then insisted that he release a statement, and he has. Here we go. This is Jason's statement. I want to preface it by saying, in conversation, he did not exhibit any of the conventional signs that are indicative of a hoaxer. His story more or less stayed consistently ambiguous. This is Jason Lorifice's statement. I corrected the punctuation, spelling, and tense shifts from his original statement, but he agrees that this is the definitive account of the event. On the weekend of July 25th, 2009, I was down in the Bridgewater area for 3 days investigating the alleged mysteries of the Bridgewater Triangle. I decided to spend 1 day dedicated to the Hockomock Swamp to look for strange creatures and bizarre beasts, and yes, even Bigfoot. I started off in Raynham, where the power lines crossed Route 138, that's where my expedition went, and mountain biked the dirt path that runs parallel to those power lines. After about 1.5 hours, I decided to move to another location. Finally, I ended up in the Bridgewater area near Lake Nippinicket and biked the area there as well. That is when I discovered what looked to be human-shaped footprints in the cornfield, but much larger. As I examined the prints closer, I noticed that a trail of them looked as if someone or something had crossed the road and into the cornfield, where it made its way towards the swamp. I did, in fact, see some of the crops pushed aside as if something large has passed through it. Due to the fact that it was late in the afternoon, I was faced with two options: either pursue the tracks into the thick, dense brush and try to track it, or race back into town and buy some plaster of Paris at Home Depot and make a mold of one of the tracks. Boy, for somebody who never hunted Bigfoot, knew what the protocol was, huh? When I returned to the site with plaster, I also measured the tracks and found some inconsistencies in the stride pattern. The first five tracks had a stride length of approximately 87 inches from heel to toe. What did Bob Beamon jump in the 68 Olympics? 29 feet? The next four after that measured approximately 78 inches to 79 inches. You can't make a hoax, make it big, huh? The length of the feet were about 18 inches by 7 inches. My guess was, if it had been a person's foot, they would have been at least 8.5 feet tall. I had to prep the footprint by blowing out the loose dirt in the toes, and I had to pick out some plants before pouring the mold. By the way, it was the year without a summer in Boston in 2009. Rained all of June and July. Upon waiting for the mold to dry, about 45 minutes, I saw more than 50 birds shoot out of the trees like a bat out of hell. With the concern that whatever made those tracks may have returned, I sat there quietly for about 10 minutes and didn't make a sound. Unfortunately, I didn't see or hear anything. After pulling the cast out of the ground, I was walking back to the car when I noticed a car pull up and the driver asked me if I was having car problems. I told him that I was fine and I showed him the cast. His eyes lit up like a pair of headlights. He told me that he and his wife had lived in the area for over 20 years and that he'd never heard of any Bigfoot stories around there. He then turned to his wife in the car and said, "Shotgun's loaded tonight." As I looked back, I realized that I was very excited to find such a discovery that I failed to photograph the area more thoroughly and survey it better than what I did. He says that he saw corn stalks pushed back. He didn't take a photograph of that. He saw multiple footprints. He didn't take photographs of that. But he did take a photograph of himself posing with it. You'll see that in a second. I would just like to clear something up. I'm a paranormal investigator, so I don't prove or disprove unexplained events. I simply present my findings. I wasn't there when the tracks were made, so I can't say if it was a Bigfoot or a prankster. So that's like saying, if I go 10 miles out into a woods and put a fake track hoping that somebody would find it, he wasn't the victim of a prankster. I'm still open to the possibility that it could be a hoax, but deep down inside, I want to believe that it was a creature in the swamp. Believe the latter, not the former. Since that time, I've got a lot of mud thrown my way because of all this, and I sometimes wish that I never found those tracks, you think? So for now, my conclusion is that it is of unknown origin. That's my summary of how I came into possession of this enormous footprint cast. End quote. I discovered the location off of Elm Street, where I told him to go on August 17, 2009, and told Jason. On Saturday, the Saturday before that, August 15th, Jason offered to make his own hoaxed big footprints at his home in Burlington, Vermont, and sent me his photographs, and we'll look at those in a moment. So there we go. That's Jason posing with the cast. You can see how small the corn growth is at the end of July. July 25th, I think this was taken, or July 30th. And now here's the footprint, huh? With his right foot against it. Look at the toes. Too perfect. Now there's his foot next to the pull cast. Now, Dr. Meldrum knows anatomy, and I don't know how that thing would stand if that were a real footprint. That's a skeptic in me. So here's a photograph of, I found the area. Look at how taller the corner is. This is 3 weeks later, and we had a heat spell. Nightmare off of Elm Street. Another photo here. So I found the place, and I walked the area, and I didn't find any knocked down corn stalks, any footprints. And I think if there were knocked down corn stalks, I would have been able to locate them. I stood on the roof of my car, too, and roof of my Honda Element, and I couldn't see any depressed areas or areas where the corn was much smaller. But that's the exact location where he had the photograph taken. Now the hoax footprints. Now, if all of us went out and made hoax Bigfoot footprints, we'd pretty do a good job. I tend to think it would look like that if we did hoax footprints. But so here's his effort at doing a hoax Bigfoot, and it's lame. No effort. Poor job. Here's his second effort. And why are you doing it in sopping mud when you could have done it in soft soil? Overkill. Trying to sell the drama. And then this one here. I couldn't have possibly made a hoax print because it's the best one I can make. And this one here. Again, why are you using soft mud? I don't understand. And then, of course, an authentic smiley face. So, there's Jason holding his cast. Close up, all right? Close up of the footprint. And my theory is, this foot could not possibly support a large primate. And I offer an opinion of Dr. Meldrum and looking at that. That's just my theory. I am not an expert in any stretch of the imagination, but it just looks too weird. So I ask you this in closing. There are many prominent Bigfoot hunters and researchers in this room right now with vastly more experience than I, and have participated in many expeditions in search of Sasquatch and have come up with little, if any, tangible evidence. Jason, on his first try, scored a big mama. Lucky, no? Seriously, how can a man with little knowledge of Bigfoot find footprints, only photograph one of them, pull a very detailed cast on his first try from an area that I sent him to? I think Don told me the first cast he tried to pour he ruined, and I'm sure some of you guys, it's pretty difficult to pour plaster, am I not? I mean, some of you guys know how to pour molds, but it got messy until you refined your process. So Bigfoot on demand. Great luck. I maintain that the footprint that he holds his shoe to is different from the casted footprint. I'll go back to that photo. I think they're different. That's my theory. You agree, sport? Show of hands, please. And I think we can throw the lights on. I'm all done here. Raise your hand if you think that this case is authentic. Ha! All right, dude, I got you. All right, that's all right. You can be the minority. That's all right, man. There's so many acronyms with Bigfoot organizations. New England Sasquatch Research. NESRA? Anybody from NESRA here? You guys, are you Corey? Corey Amon Stone? Corey? Are you guys? Okay. Because he called me up and he was kind of upset that I summarily dismissed this case, and I got curt with him because I felt that he was acting like the Bigfoot district attorney from the area, and I kind of resented that. And you know, if it looks like a rat, it smells like a rat, it acts like a rat, it is a rat. So how many people think this is a hoax? I rest my case. Thank you very much. A couple of questions. Yes, sir. Yeah? Do I have time? Can I play it? I can actually play it. Look at that. Nice segue. We didn't even talk. Can I play it? Okay, here we go. I'm going to play this taxi grabber story. Essentially, Dave Smith told me this story in September of 1998. A woman is driving a taxi cab in Stoddard, New Hampshire, when she gets lost on an old logging road called Turtle Rock Road. When she tries to turn around, she backs into a tree that turned out to be a gorilla with green eyes and tried to grab the cab. Here we go. Let's see if this works. Hold on. Wait for it. Anonymous testimony. Hold on, you guys. I got it. It's not keying for some reason. Let me go to my desktop. Okay, locations of Chinese subs in the Pacific Rim. History page of sports. Let me go back there. It should show up here. Hieronymus testimony type. I'm looking for the audio file here. Bridgewater Triangle MP3, Bigfoot in the Past. Hieronymus testimony. Let me see if this works. Hold on. Let me just... Well, I seem to have lost my momentum here, so I just don't see the AVI MPEG. What was that?
Is there anybody in Massachusetts who isn't on drugs?
Yes. Teddy Kennedy, and he's dead. No, I don't think they're... Many people, there are a lot of people heavily medicated, yes, that multiple prescriptions. And in if you look at the news in New England, you have top stories, then they have brazen Vicodin and Percocet robberies, then they go to the weather, then they go to sports, and then they see the hit and runs. But we're slowly moving from a liberal state back, fortunately, to the Republican side. We're swinging back to the right. And I had a fortune of Scott Brown announce a basketball game a couple of weeks ago with him, met his daughter Ayla and his wife Gail, and I'm just glad that somebody can bring the wackiness from the far, far left, bring it back to center again. I can't find that audio file, which I should. I do have it, but if I do have it on another file, if you want to come over to the table, I'll definitely play it for you. I think you'll think it's pretty cool. It's a story that Dave told me a bunch of stories in... 1998. Some are all folklore third hand, but this was a pretty neat one. Basically, I'll tell you the story. Is the woman is driving a cab. She's got the late shift. She drops off her last fare. She gets lost on a logging road called Turtle Rock Road in Stoddard, New Hampshire. She goes up to turn around, does a three-point turn. Well, in her case, it's probably a five-point turn. Backs up. She thinks she hits a tree, except said tree is a furry tree. And as she's trying to drive away, she said something grabbed at the top of the roof and held her progress there. So she calls into the dispatcher, Dave Smith, and says, "I think a bear tried to grab my cab. What are you talking about?" "Well, it was a gorilla." "A gorilla? You're talking about a squash squash." That's what he called it, squash squash. And then Dave started collecting stories around New Hampshire, and then he went missing. I never talked to him after September of 1998. Never got a hold of him again. So, any other questions? Many useless folks organizing nothing. Here's my point about MUFON, and I've been there 15 years, and they inadvertently perpetuate the UFO cover-up, because a lot of information goes in and nothing comes out. And I'm only in MUFON just to get their journal, which is pretty neat. But I just think it's a dinosaur organization of a bygone era. Any other questions or any other organization that I can insult? Yes. No, I know plenty of people that have, but I never interviewed Bill Bartlett, John Baxter, or Abby Bramham, or Will Tainter. I know that Bill Bartlett recently spoke about it as recently as 2 years ago, but none of them have backed off on their story. And there are no really reputable UFO sightings that took place during that time period in that area where you could equate, because it sounds like your classic gray, a classic alien, that you could equate to that particular incident. But it's one of those anomalous incidents that took place over the course of 24 hours. You know, some people have called it a hoax, but I've always found it to be fascinating. Yes, sir?
What was that you said about the fanatic
VFRO? Well, I find them to be, how can I say, militant, defiant, and to have their own agenda, and... that's it. I just don't like the organization. I want nothing to do with them. And I have that right, okay? So, and said, tell Matt I said hello. Thank you. Anybody else?
I just wondered what the doctor did compare them? Compare the past and the...
I couldn't see. I was watching the program over his shoulder, and the inserted graphics, I was at the wrong angle on the screen, so... I've got a note to ask him to send to me.
So the doctor is reserving comments, is what he's saying. Well done. Well played. Anything else? Great. Thank you very much. God bless you.